Top stories. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says Israel's plan to normalize ties with the Arab world is doomed to failure since regional people oppose it. Iran's leader points to U.S. miscalculations, saying the Americans are receiving blows from an area they never suspected. An unofficial report reveals that the U.S. trade deficit hits its highest level last year, as deficit in goods and services rose by 27% in 2021. Welcome to the program. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says Iran's foes cannot easily attack the country. In an interview with Iran's Al Alam TV, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said, "It's not in the U.S. interest to attack Iran, as it cannot stop Tehran's peaceful nuclear activities." Nasrallah said he believes Israel's repeated threats in recent months to attack Iran's nuclear sites are all empty words, and the regime will not make the mistake of launching a war on Iran. Nasrallah said Tel Aviv knows if it strikes Iran, the response will be harsh, decisive, and precise. He said some Arab states that normalize ties with Israel can't help the regime militarily. Nasrallah also touched on recent diplomatic contacts between Israel and some Arab states. He said Israel's plan to normalize ties with the Arab world is doomed to failure since people in the region oppose it.
In Bahrain, they will not be supportive of Iran. Even inside Saudi Arabia, the Saudi society, not with normalization of ties, even those who go on televisions. This is Egypt, this is Jordan, this is Northern Africa, Indonesia, Malaysia, Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan, all the Arab and Islamic world.
Nasrallah said the regime's normalization efforts are mainly aimed at pushing Palestinians to a state of despair so they accept defeat and give up on their cause to liberate their lands. He said Palestinians will resist such plots as they are brave and steadfast on the U.S. sanctions on Hezbollah. Nasrallah said such measures will not have a major impact on the resistance movement. He said the U.S. sanctions war cannot stop Hezbollah's growth and development. Nasrallah also referred to Yemen's recent retaliatory strikes against the UAE. He said Abu Dhabi had to plead for help from Western countries following the attacks. Nasrallah said such attacks will continue until the UAE and Saudi Arabia stop their aggression against the people of Yemen. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei, says the enemy has launched hybrid warfare against the country, targeting it in various areas ranging from politics and economy to security, media, and diplomacy. Ayatollah Khamenei said Iran cannot always maintain a defensive strategy in the face of such hostility and should also go on the offensive in various areas such as security, economy, and media. Elsewhere, the leader pointed to U.S. miscalculations, saying Americans are receiving blows from an area they never suspected, namely their own presidents. He explained that the current and former American presidents have joined hands to destroy their remaining U.S. reputation. The leader also noted that Western powers claim they advocate freedom of expression, but in fact resort to what he called media dictatorship. Ayatollah Khamenei cited the censorship of social media posts on Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, Iran's anti-terror icon, who was assassinated by the U.S. in 2020. The leader said Western powers place a media ban on every word or image that runs counter to their policies. He made the remarks in a meeting with a group of commanders and staff members of Iran's Air Force. The meeting marks the historic declaration of allegiance of Iranian Air Force officers to the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back on February the 8th, 1979. Iran says it is ready to reach, in the shortest possible time, a good agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. The comment was made by the Iranian foreign minister, who spoke with his Russian counterpart on the phone. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, however, noted that for a speedy agreement, the West needs not only to be realistic, but also take real and concrete measures. He also stressed that Iran is resolutely seeking a good agreement within the framework of its interests and rights. Meanwhile, Sergei Lavrov said the importance of removing anti-Iran sanctions, urging all parties, especially the U.S., to return to their commitments under the JCPOA, This comes as Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal resumed talks in the Austrian capital on Tuesday in a bid to revive the accord. Iran's southwestern city of Ahvaz has hosted an exhibition showcasing the latest domestically produced petroleum equipment. The event comes as Iran is trying to indigenize its oil sector in the wake of U.S. sanctions. Youssef Jalali reports.
Iran's oil-rich city of Ahvaz is hosting one of the major oil shows in the country. The Ahvaz Oil Exhibition brought together 210 local firms active in the production of petroleum equipment, as well as contractors of mega oil projects. The aim of the four-day event is to support manufacturers of key petroleum equipment that are in the list of U.S. sanctions.
One of our major products is the two-phase flow pump, which is a vital piece in the oil exploration process. We used to be dependent on foreign supply of this equipment, and due to the sanctions, it was really hard to access it. So we decided to rely on our domestic expertise, and we now build two-phase pumps locally. We also specialize in the production and execution of all kinds of offshore oil rigs from A to Z.
For decades, Iran has relied on drilling bits produced by Germany, the U.S., and even China to pump its crude. But Washington's oil embargoes on Iran made it almost impossible to import efficient bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This forced Iran to try its own know-how to build this needed machinery, including drilling bits. And the result is beyond expectation.
Because of the sanctions, the oil industrial companies... Could not import these very important drilling rigs. So in these years, we made more than 300 drilling bits and PDC bits. And we manufactured it domestically. And we think that we can continue manufacturing all of the needs of Iran.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 deal and the reimposition of sanctions the same year, Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs, down from 2.5 million. This prompted the country to rebuild its oil sector using its domestic know-how, a long-term goal which, if accomplished, will make the country an oil power.
Less than a century ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. Today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector. Experts here say this would be another turning point in the oil industry, since it would shield the country's crude from the blows of U.S. sanctions. Youssef Jalali from the city of Ahvaz.
An official report reveals that the U.S. trade deficits surged to its highest level last year, as Americans were more inclined to purchasing foreign products. According to the figure released by the Commerce Department, the overall trade deficit in goods and services rose by 27% to nearly $860 billion in 2021. U.S. imports also outpaced its exports due to the high demand for foreign goods and industrial materials, hitting an all-time high of $1.8 trillion. The data also show that imports from China hit their highest level since 2018, reaching more than $506 billion over the same period. The country was hit by a trade deficit as its economy continues to recover from the 2020 recession fueled by the coronavirus pandemic. The busiest land crossing between the U.S. and Canada remains shut as Canadian truckers continue blocking roads in protest at the government's coronavirus measures. Trucks and other vehicles have blocked the lanes, causing gridlock for 2 days now. The so-called Freedom Convoy began as a movement against the vaccine requirement for cross-border truckers. The movement soon morphed into protests against public health measures and the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government. On Monday, Parliament held an emergency session to deal with the issue. Addressing the session, Trudeau demanded an end to the demonstrations, which have been ongoing for 12 days now. Meanwhile, New Zealand witnessed the protest, inspired by demonstrations in Canada, with hundreds of people blocking the roads to the Parliament building. Earlier, we spoke to political commentator Edward Corrigan to get his thoughts on the truckers' protests in Canada. He believes the demonstrations are the result of a campaign by right-wing parties that is also attracting people with other grievances.
90% of the truckers actually are fully vaccinated. In Ontario, approximately 90% of the population is fully vaccinated. And the complaint that the truckers have is, in some respect, I think, misguided, because they want to have an open border that they are exempt from having vaccinations and having to report. Now, it's the United States government that has the rule that prevents Canadian truckers from leaving Canada and going into the United States. And Canada has the same rule where American truckers who come into Canada have to be fully vaccinated and have documentation to back that up. So the Canadian truckers, you know, they're sort of, I think, banging on the door very loudly, but they're banging on the wrong door, and I don't think they can change anything. Partly because there's a right-wing party that is putting its resources behind this the Freedom Convoy and the anti-vaxxer campaign. So there is a bit of a political organization that is supplanting and increasing the numbers. It also has become, you know, I guess, a magnet for attracting people with other complaints. You see, you know, actually in some of the convoys, we see, you know, United States Confederate flags, you know, a lot of attacks on, on Trudeau and the government. So it's become, you know, and people are frustrated and they're tired and they want this to end. But I think, you know, to end it prematurely is would be a mistake.
NATO announces plans to ensure a larger permanent presence of its forces in Eastern Europe. Critics say the move is designed to further provoke Russia. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
We are closest allies and working.
In recent days, a series of separate delegations from the EU have traveled to the United States, Ukraine and Russia as tensions between the West and Moscow show no sign of abating. The Kremlin insists the security of Russian citizens is paramount and therefore Ukraine cannot be allowed to join NATO. On Monday, the head of the 30-nation alliance confirmed additional NATO forces have been moved to Eastern Europe and there's a plan to make that permanent.
There is a process now going on within NATO, also, of course, in close consultation with our military commanders, to adjust our presence in the eastern part of the alliance.
Peace activists claim NATO is being unnecessarily provocative.
We would have a lot of advantages only with one symbolical sentence, not to expand with Ukraine and Georgia. And then Putin would be satisfied and you can make agreements with him.
The EU is sending huge amounts of money to Kiev.
More than 17 billion euros.
Even though the bloc's own agencies say Ukraine is corrupt at the highest levels, EU citizens are worried the situation could exacerbate the bloc's energy crisis, given that we import so much from Russia.
Putting in danger European gas supplies, so this is really frightening to me personally, and I think the whole European population should be frightened about this.
That could be a solution for the energy crisis. Everybody just spend less money on army and more money on compensation kind of energy support for the people.
A number of political commentators say some senior figures in the EU and NATO believe the West is pushing Russia a bit too far. Double standards and hypocrisy are at play, according to impartial foreign policy analysts.
They remind us the United States has approximately 800 military bases in 80 nations around the world. This as Russia is vilified for moving troops within its own borders. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Britons are dealing with a combination of higher energy costs and rising food prices. We've discussed that issue with our guest in our news review program. Take a look, please. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The United Kingdom is facing a rise in inflation at rates not seen in the past three decades. A major retail company is now warning that the worst is yet to come. Britain's biggest retailer, Tesco, says the prices of its products can go up as much as 5% in the months to come. The company blames on the matter the rise in energy bills. That is partly due to the cold winter, lower gas deliveries from Russia, and tensions in Eastern Europe.
Last week, the Bank of England raised interest rates for the second time in 3 months, after forecasting that the peak inflation will reach record 7% in April. Let's get up to speed with Amina Taylor, a correspondent who joins us from London. Okay, Amina, over to you. Not obviously news that's at all promising anything good for the economy of the UK, and in particular the average person in the UK, starting with the energy prices, in particular gas prices. From what we understand, for the month of April is going to hit about 53%. Tell us these economic indicators and what it means for the average person at this point, based on what you have.
Well, Kaveh, I can just tell you in two very, very short, simple words. It's bad news, because some of the indices that you mentioned there, you're talking about a rise in interest rates, which means great if you have money that you can put into a bank account for your savings, because your interest is going to go up on that one. But if, like myself, you have a mortgage rate coming to an end or something like that, you'll be paying more for the same service. You're also then talking about this energy squeeze and the energy crisis. Now, we talked a couple months and weeks ago when we had those queues at the fuel depots and we had the queues at the service stations and so on. The price of just filling up your car has gone up, which means that the price of filling up your lorries have gone up. And that means that the supply chain, as you indicated there with the Tesco's news, there is going to be a cost to the consumer. And you know, 5% might not sound like much, but if you're already in a situation where you know your personal energy bills are going to go up, you mentioned there the 53%, that is an increase. That's not how much it's going to be. That is on top of what you're already paying.
Amina Taylor, correspondent there, talking to us from London. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
Congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
In the limelight.
In Britain, allies of Prime Minister Boris Johnson have insisted that grown-ups are now in charge of his operation as he heads into a critical week for his beleaguered premiership that could see him face a confidence vote and the threat of further damaging revelations. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's deputy political editor, Rowena Mason. The piece is titled, Johnson Allies Insist Grown-ups in Charge of New Team at Number 10. Britain allies of Prime Minister Boris Johnson have insisted that grown-ups are now in charge of his operation as he heads into a critical week for his beleaguered premiership that could see him face a confidence vote and the threat of further damaging revelations. Tory MPs said Johnson may have bought some time by bringing a new team into number 10. One major Conservative donor, Alexander Tomurko, told The Guardian, "The Prime Minister should now take the opportunity to purge the cabinet of disloyal leadership rivals." However, critics of Boris Johnson's leadership say they thought the number of letters of no confidence in the Prime Minister was now not far off the 54 necessary to trigger a ballot on his premiership. "It's really hard to know, but I'm pretty sure the numbers are in the 40s, so it's only a small surge that could take it over the line," said one former cabinet minister. Having said that, he may well survive the vote itself. There are people doing that calculation, saying they'll hold off until they think he'll lose. Boris Johnson is also facing the possibility of more revelations from Dominic Cummings, his former senior advisor. Cummings, who revealed details of some of number 10 parties, is said to be planning to raise further questions this week about the furore over the funding of his £112,000 flat refurbishment, initially funded through a loan from a Conservative donor. A report in the Sunday Times also said the Prime Minister's wife was tiring of the pressure they're both under. More than 15 Conservative MPs have called on Boris Johnson to resign, about half of whom have publicly confirming that they have submitted letters of no confidence in the Prime Minister. On Sunday, Mark Harper, a former chief whip and major skeptic of COVID rules, gave a scathing assessment of the Prime Minister's conduct, saying, "Number 10's repeated denials, changing stories and drift resulting from the scandal around unlawful lockdown parties have led to many of my constituents questioning the Prime Minister's honesty, integrity and fitness for office. These views now appear to be widespread across the country." He added, "Conservatives still have so much to offer to our country, so it's vital for Conservative MPs to consider all the options necessary to get our party back on track." Number 10 Downing Street is planning a fight back this week, with a series of policy announcements to show it is trying to turn the page on the Partygate scandal. Even though 12 gatherings are still under police investigation and a final Sue Gray report is yet to be published. Boris Johnson has also implemented several staff changes, bringing in Guta Hari, a former aide and a former BBC journalist, and his new communications director, and making Cabinet Office Minister Steve Barclay his Chief of Staff. Henry Newman, a Deputy Chief of Staff and ally of Kerry Johnson, is expected to return to a role with his former boss Michael Gove. Guta Hari told The Guardian he was proud to join a team of capable, grown-up, professional and pragmatic people that will hopefully allow the Prime Minister and his Cabinet to operate effectively and deliver what they promised to the people. He added that there were big post-pandemic challenges that they would really need to get on with. Guta Hari's appointment was for the main part welcomed by Tory MPs, despite his having backed Remain in the European Union referendum, with two senior Brexit-supporting MPs saying it was very positive and a return at long last to sensible appointments. One said it would hopefully provide more stability after the era of Dominic Cummings and the subsequent era of aides close to the Prime Minister's wife. However, there was more scepticism among some Tory MPs about Steve Barclay's role. One MP said he was seen with suspicion by some who believed he's an ally of Rishi Sunak. The Chancellor has given Johnson only lukewarm support over the parties and distanced himself from number 10 over the Prime Minister's false Jimmy Savile slur towards Labour leader Keir Starmer. Experts have also questioned whether Steve Barclay is taken on too wide a brief, with his cabinet office ministerial role in addition to his chief of staff job and responsibilities as an MP. A spokesman said many of his ministerial responsibilities would be redistributed to other ministers within the cabinet office. With Boris Johnson's future still hanging by a thread, major Conservative donor Alexander Tomurko, who has given more than £600,000 to the Conservative Party, said he was urging other donors and his friends in Parliament to continue supporting Boris Johnson. The Ukrainian-born businessman who co-owns an energy firm called Aquind last month threatened legal action against the government for turning down its plans to build a controversial £1.2 billion electricity and internet cable running from the UK to France. Alexander Tomurko said, "Our party leader, Boris Johnson, is today the best candidate to be Prime Minister. He now has nothing to lose, and so must be bold and thus make urgent decisions to stabilise the situation in the energy market and the general economy, I believe. I can only recommend him to consider a serious reshuffle and to purge from the cabinet those who try to trigger internal party contests rather than focusing on their ministerial duties." Penny Mordaunt, the Conservative MP for Portsmouth North and a former Defence Secretary, had led calls opposing the project, saying it was not helpful to the UK's energy security. The majority owner of the energy firm Aquind was revealed in 2020 to be Viktor Fedotov, a Russian-born billionaire.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and how about reflecting on a wise aphorism from Imam Ali al-Naghi al-Hadi, peace be upon him, the 10th successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Do not expect honesty and purity of intention from someone who has suffered from your malice. Do not expect loyalty from one to whom you have been disloyal. Do not expect goodwill from someone whom you regard with ill will, as his heart towards you is the same as your heart towards him.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah
Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi as-salam. We were looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen and how he wanted to establish a system that is fair for everybody. A system where the poor are fed. A system where the security of people have been enforced. An environment where everyone could live in peace. Without these prerequisites, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi could not invite people to accept any Islamic rules or regulations, because when one is hungry, the last thing on his mind would be him trying to practice religion. I mean, obviously, we don't include everybody, but for the majority of the common people, that is the case. With Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he could not tolerate that he should sit quietly in his house when the poor citizens, the poor Muslims, were being subjected to oppression, either by those who were before him or those who came during his time and after him, especially during the time of Muawiyah, where Muawiyah was being oppressive to people. A brave and a steadfast person like Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam could not let the Muslim fall a prey to the atrocities of the wolves of Bani Umayyah and remain silent and watches everything and remains silent. Of course, this is not the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib, that we know. If he had not come to rescue the Muslims at that difficult moment where they needed him the most, he would have been treated as a coward and not the brave and valiant person as he is known through history. Through the actions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, he determined and he wrote his name in the books of history. And not just him, that's with everyone else, especially for those who are in position of power or those who are under those who are oppressors. If we remain silent and accept oppression that falls on us or that falls on our fellow citizen, fellow men, kinsmen, then we are nothing but cowards. But if we fight, if we stand up for our rights, if we speak up, then history will record and write us as brave heroes. And history, this is what it has been doing since it began, for all those who stood against oppressors are considered to be heroes. And all those who went with the oppressors for the sake of their own desires, for the sake of their own interests, have been looked at as villains and have been looked at as cowardice. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he saw the Muslims in need of a hero, in need of someone to stand up for the right, he rose up to the occasion. And he rose up to this occasion since he was a child, supporting the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam in his mission. Now let us take a short break, then we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back.
brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity, and we are still looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salam Allah. Amir al-Mu'mineen, he himself said, and he was quoted saying, "I was worried and alarmed lest the foolish and the wicked person should become a ruler of this nation and make the property of God their plaything and the creatures of God their slaves, and fight with the righteous and make the tyrants their helpers." Clearly in this statement, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi is highlighting a very important matter of life, and that is leadership. Those who rule, those who lead, they have two paths in front of them, two roads in front of them. They must take one. Either they decide to be just, fair, and help people and give people their right and establish a utopia for their own people. That's path number one. Or path number two is them becoming tyrants, and they will enslave people, so the people became their slaves, and their wealth and their property becomes their plaything. This is in the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen. At the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, each, whether it's him or Banu Umayyah, they stood on different paths. Where Banu Umayyah, they did in fact take the servants of Allah as servants and take the property of people as their plaything or their plaything. And the righteous ones were killed and no one could stand against them. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he himself, he stood on the path of truth. He stood as a thorn in the eyes and in the hands of Banu Umayyah. And Banu Umayyah could not tolerate the justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen any longer. Therefore Muawiyah, he started trying to every possible way to get rid of Amir al-Mu'mineen, be it inciting fitna and sedition from within by bringing the case of Uthman and those who killed Uthman, and then Talha and Zubair had to go to fight Amir al-Mu'mineen in the first battle of Kamu. When that failed and Amir al-Mu'mineen continued to establish justice, Muawiyah he himself took it upon himself to rage war against Amir al-Mu'mineen, be it in Siffin or be it in Nahrawan. And then when that also failed, Muawiyah obviously, he, the only way in front of him now is to convince those in a way or another, directly or indirectly, to get rid of Amir al-Mu'mineen altogether. Because Ali alayhi salam was the embodiment of justice. Ali alayhi salam stood for the human rights. He's the one who said people are of two kinds, either a brother in faith or equal in humanity. So there was no room in the life of Ali or in the path of Ali for any person to be oppressed, for any person for his right to be taken. And therefore that was one of the reasons and the main reasons that caused Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam to surrender his soul in the mosque of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the holiest places, in a way where his blood was shed. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news, with the light.
A German man has claimed a new Guinness World Record in hula hooping. Kia Sandmeier set a new record for the longest duration of hula hooping in a plank position. He was able to carry the activity in this difficult pose for over 6 minutes. The 30-year-old says he practiced the plank rigorously in the morning and evenings before and after work. Sandmeier says holding the plank was the most difficult part. The previous record for this activity was set last year by an American with just over 3 minutes. Every year, the Copenhagen Light Festival transformed the winter cold and darkness of the capital city into a celebration of light art in Denmark. In February, the entire city becomes the stage displaying captivating lighting installations presented by Danish and international artists. The works are planted at more than 30 historical sites, canals, and squares, among other urban spaces. Building facades are also decorated with special lighting designs. The organizers and curators of the festival say the event is important because it gives people a chance to rediscover their own city. Also, the event brings life to a dark season that's normally very quiet by offering joyful experiences for locals and tourists alike.
As the 2022 Winter Olympics have begun in the Chinese capital Beijing, two playful giant pandas at the Moscow Zoo have come to the spotlight for predicting the outcome of the sports event. On the eve of the Winter Olympics opening, Ru Yi and Ding Ding were each offered 5 traffic cones labeled with national flags of the participating countries, represented by the largest numbers of athletes. The cones that got taken down by them were considered as the winners. The pandas then chose the cones with Chinese and German flags on them. Zoo officials say no treats were placed inside the cones to ensure that the prediction is unbiased. The zoo says it plans to continue the panda prediction for all individual and team competitions at the Games. Over the past few years, people have become more aware of the detrimental effect of littering on the environment. Now, a Mexican kayaker has decided to launch his own campaign to save the environment. 66-year-old Omar Menchaca usually paddles his single-seater kayak through the floating gardens of the Xochimilco canals near the Mexico City, collecting garbage left by visitors. Menchaca says he normally does the cleanup in the early morning before tourists arrive to the site, using bare hands to pick up debris. The former athlete who did his training for the competitions in the canals says over time he found that the waterways were littered with rubbish.
I knew this place, and I came to this place because here I did my training for my competitions. Unfortunately, over time, I began to notice that some canals were full of rubbish. Xochimilco is very important to me. Xochimilco is considered a World Heritage Site. It does not belong to Mexicans. It is the heritage of all human beings.
Menchaca believes that if people ignore their environment, soon there will be a time when they have nothing to enjoy. He hopes that his efforts to protect wetlands make a small difference and preserve the place for future generations. The Xochimilco site is home to endemic species, including the critically endangered ones, and is usually visited by thousands of people on weekends. The 15th edition of the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up. As Salman Khajuri reports, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. Here's more.
The 15th Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up its work.
The four-day event brought together representatives of different sectors active in tourism and handicrafts fields, including airlines, cruise lines, hotels, museums, travel agencies, insurance services, travel and tourism facilities, and masters of handicrafts. The exhibition is considered as the most appropriate platform to optimize face-to-face communication among the involved industries. From a tourism point of view, Irwan enjoys two important and unique features. The first one is Irwan's exceptional geographical location among countries in the world, and the second feature is its tourism attractions of historical, cultural, natural pilgrimage, adventurous, and other sorts.
Alamzan, your metal engraving, is an Iranian ancient metalwork art. It is engraved by chisels and hammers on different metals such as gold, silver, copper, brass, and some alloys. Its origin dates back to almost 7,000 years ago. It is the art of craving superb designs on various metals. The artistic work of this course made by the artists are the glorious and undeniable indication of previous metal work of Iran, and in particular Isfahan.
I'm from Hormuzgan province, south of Iran. Handicrafts have always been an integral part of Hormuzgan province due to the rich culture and special customs of the region. Hormuzgan province embraces scenic islands, among which Kish, Hormuz, Hengam, and Qeshm are the most beautiful ones and top tourist destinations in southern Iran.
Iran has globally registered 11 cities and 3 villages under their native handicrafts during the past 6 years, making the country a world leader in registering local productions. There are totally 602 handicrafts fields identified on a global scale. 299 fields are special to Iran, from which 199 fields are in the central Iranian province of Isfahan.
With 14 entries, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council, as China with 7 entries, Chile with 4 entries, and India with 3 ones come next. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Joyous festive mood in East Asia as the region welcomes the Lunar New Year with celebrations, including light and lantern decorations of homes and public avenues. People across China are staging a variety of events to mark the New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. Several cities have held breathtaking light shows, with many landmarks and skyscrapers dazzling with colorful images. In the capital, Beijing, the light shows feature elements of the Winter Olympics as the city is getting ready to host the International Games this week. Elsewhere, Malaysians welcome the Year of the Tiger with an underwater lion dance performance in an aquarium in the capital, Kuala Lumpur. The citizens have welcomed the return of the annual event, which had been called off the previous year due to COVID-19 restrictions.
A lot happier as compared to during the lockdown period where you're alone and you do things alone. You feel very lonely, right? Now that you get to be in touch with your family, yeah, it's a lot better.
Even though we still keep the social distance, but however, I feel the freedom to go out and visit and do the things that I like to do.
Celebrations are also underway in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Indonesia. The Lunar New Year, seen as a time of reunion and rebirth, is celebrated by more than 2 billion people worldwide, especially amongst Asian communities. The festivities last for over a fortnight.
Stunning light shows and hanging lanterns have illuminated cities across China to welcome the new Lunar Year, also called the Spring Festival. The city of Zigong has taken the spotlight with a sea of lanterns, turning it into a scene straight out of a fairy tale. The city is famous for lantern making and brings a festive mood this time around every year. The lanterns are usually made in all kinds and shapes, including legendary creatures representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, which is decorated vividly on special couplets. The New Year festivities officially begin on Tuesday and will continue for 15 days. The Lunar New Year is considered the largest migration of people in the world, as millions travel back to their towns and villages to mark the event.
Sub-zero temperatures in the Midwestern U.S. haven't held anglers back from participating in the world's largest charitable ice fishing contest. Some 10,000 people from across the world gathered in the state of Minnesota to put their ice fishing skills to test. They dug thousands of holes in Gull Lake in a matter of hours. Some $200,000 in prizes were up for grabs in the contest. The volunteer-led annual event has so far raised about $4 million for 67 charities since it was first held in 1991. Beryl Carr is a special volunteer at a hospital in London. What makes her special, you might wonder? Well, the fact that she celebrated her 100th birthday last month. Carr has been volunteering in Ealing Hospital for more than 18 years. She works in the hospital's cafe and says her work is her lifeline. This incredible 100-year-old lady says she enjoys helping those who are not as fortunate as she is, and that she has no intentions of retiring. The hospital staff say her presence has been very motivating.
Many of us look at her. She's always got a smile on her face, a swagger as she walks. And you come back from a clinic or a ward round, you're absolutely tired, and she just inspires you as soon as you see her.
Even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped Carr from volunteering. Born in a nearby town, Carr says she moved back to the neighborhood more than two decades ago after the death of her husband. When asked about the secret to her long and healthy life, she refused to answer, saying she's not planning on revealing that secret. A surprise in a Chinese zoo ahead of the Lunar New Year. 15 rare golden tigers make debut in front of excited fans. A large group of visitors gathered in China's Yellow River Delta Zoo to watch the rare animals. This zoo is the largest breeding base for golden species of tigers across China. The animals are being strictly protected amid fear surrounding their extinction. The golden tigers are a variant of Bengali tigers with rare color variations, including black stripes. They are no longer extant in the wild.
The most powerful telescope ever built in the world is now at its final destination in space. After traveling for nearly 1 month, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has reached its final parking spot in space, which is approximately 1 million miles away from Earth. The mission of the tennis court-sized telescope is to explore the cosmos and better understand the early days of the universe. The $10 billion telescope will also carefully monitor faraway exoplanets and study the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. It's more advanced than NASA's iconic Hubble telescope. The streets in the Taiwanese capital are decorated vividly to welcome the Year of the Tiger beginning on February the 5th. Residents are using tiger sculptures and totems to adorn the streets of Taipei. Shops are booming as people head out to buy special couplets ahead of the new year, also called the Spring Festival. Many are hoping they can completely defeat COVID-19 this year, as celebrations were scaled down due to the pandemic last year. The Chinese New Year is celebrated by almost 2 billion people across the world, though mainly in Asia. There are 12 animals representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, a symbol of strength and power.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bahizi, 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 ey shahidon e rah e khoda, ey karde bahre ehya e haq jon fada, kas qatre قطره خون پاک شما می روید تا ابد در وطن ناله ها. برخیزی 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 برخیزی.
In the limelight.
The appointment of an MP to be Chief of Staff is highly unusual and suggests British Prime Minister Boris Johnson may have faced problems in recruiting an outsider to the role at a time when many in Whitehall believe he will not last much longer at number 10. We now present you an article written jointly by Toby Helm, Mark Townsend and James Tapper. The piece is titled Partygate, Loyalist Warns Johnson's Removal is Now Inevitable. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's desperate efforts to save his premiership were undermined on Saturday, 5th of February, as one of his most loyal backbench supporters said it was now inevitable that Tory MPs would remove him from office over the Partygate scandal. In an interview with The Observer, Sir Charles Walker, a former vice chairman of the 1922 Committee of Backbench Conservative MPs, implored the Prime Minister to go of his own accord in the national interest, and likened the events in the Tory party to a Greek tragedy. Sir Charles Walker said, "It is an inevitable tragedy. He is a student of Greek and Roman tragedy. It is going to end in him going, so I just want him to have some agency in that." Sir Charles Walker claimed that, in his view, Boris Johnson had got many things right, including the handling of the vaccine rollout, and deserved to be remembered for them, rather than suffer the indignity of losing a leadership challenge. But he said the succession of parties in Downing Street during national lockdowns had focused the anger of a traumatized country on number 10 Downing Street in a way that could only be addressed if the Prime Minister moved aside. Sir Charles Walker said, "It's just not going to get better." On Saturday night, 5th of February, Johnson moved to shore up his operation at number 10, which was rocked by the resignations of five key aides on Thursday, 3rd of February. On Saturday night, 5th of February, Boris Johnson moved to shore up his operation at number 10, which was rocked by resignations of five key aides on Thursday, 3rd of February. By appointing the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Steve Barclay, as his Chief of Staff, and Gutto Harry, who worked for him when Johnson was Mayor of London, as his Director of Communications. The appointment of an MP to be Chief of Staff is highly unusual and suggests Johnson may have faced problems in recruiting an outsider to the role at a time when many in Whitehall doubt he will last much longer at number 10. Gutto Harry's appointment is also a surprise, as he has strongly criticised Johnson in recent years, including saying in 2018 that he would be hugely divisive as Prime Minister. backbench Tory MP Sir Charles Walker is understood not to have submitted